Welcome to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Well, it's all right, riding around in the breeze. Well, it's all right, if you live the life you please. Well, it's all right.
Oh, great to be here today on this beautiful spring Seattle day. What a fine day to take your dog for a walk, as always. It really, truly is today. It's not a stretch at all. Here, excited to air my second interview with Temple Grandin. Interviewed her a little bit over a year ago. It was a year ago, March. I had her on the show for the first time, and I'll be talking with her again today when we come back from break. Sort of one of the main things that inspired me to have her back on the show, in addition to the fact that she's amazing and such a pleasure to talk with and brilliant, was this idea of pigs. I see on social media quite a bit these quote unquote mini pigs or micro pigs. And well, how aren't they such great pets and aren't they so cute? And yes, they are adorable, but they get very big, even the smaller pigs. And there's a lot to know and understand about them. And that it's not just like having a dog, even though a lot of times you hear people say about pigs that they are as smart as dogs, a lot of times in defense of them used as food. So I wanted to talk with Temple Grandin and hear her thoughts, given her expertise in animals in general, and especially her experience with livestock and farm animals, and to kind of hear her view on that. And so I got to talk with her about that, and then we sort of drifted into conversation about other things. She's always a pleasure to talk with and has so many great insights. I wanted to dedicate this show, and it's such a wonderful one to dedicate, to another amazing woman, my grandmother, who just passed away last weekend. I know last week when I was in the booth, she had sort of just recently taken a turn, and I had shared that with you guys, and she actually did end up passing very peacefully and beautifully on Sunday. It was the same day that I found out about the Orlando shooting, so it was not a great day. But she always had a dachshund. When I was little, she had a dachshund who. His name was Sonia. She was a black and tan, smooth dachshund, and we had great memories about Sonny and how she would have to chase her out of her garden because Sonia would get into her green beans and eat them off the plant. And we would laugh. And I remember one time when I was little, I was annoying Sonia and sort of bouncing the little tuft. I think she was overweight, bouncing the little tuft on her chest. Of fat, and she bit me in the lip, and I deserved it, and I never did it again. And I think I'll do a show at some point soon about dogs biting children, because I've been unfortunately getting a lot of calls in my work doing helping people with dog training and behavior that they have a dog that just bit their child. What do we do? And there's a lot to know about that. And I think that that is something that has shifted in over the decades of, to some degree, we just need to teach kids to act appropriately around other dogs. And then in some situations, it is actually dangerous and not a good fit to have the dog continue to live with the child. So anyway, there's a lot there. That's one of my memories of Nana's dachshund, was that she bit me, and I fully am aware that I deserved it. And, she got to meet my dachshund. One of our pack is a dachshund, and her name's Leia, and she's 13 years old. And we moved my grandmother up here from Florida just a month ago to spend some time with her. She was 102, and we didn't think that she would be leaving us so quickly, but she did, and that is her timing. So I certainly honor and respect that, but I was so glad that she got to meet Leia. And she got such a kick out of her and would especially just crack up when she saw her bury herself under blankets. So it's been quite a week, and I'm doing a lot of reflecting, a lot of writing, and appreciating, the love that I have in my life. And that's really all that matters. So Try to be present to that today. And this interview with Temple Grandin is dedicated to my grandmother, Lena Rose. Enjoy. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Temple Grandin. You're listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
Oh, hot diggity dog, ziggity boom, what you do to me? It's so new to me. What you do to me? Hot diggity dog, ziggity boom, what you do to me?
The Natural Pet Pantry is Seattle's original source for wholesome dog and cat meals, offering 8 different protein options to accommodate your pet's dietary needs. Made locally using all U.S.-sourced ingredients, their freshly ground stews, raw or cooked, can be purchased from their 2 stores in Burien and Kirkland, most independent pet supply stores, or delivered right to your door. Go to naturalpetpantry.com for more information. I'm Julie Forbes, and my first choice for my pet's food is the Natural Pet Pantry. It's the educated choice. This summer, pack up the dog bowls and head to the Lodges on Vashon. Just a 20-minute ferry ride from West Seattle, Vashon Island is the perfect quick getaway for you, your family, and your furry friend. The Lodges on Vashon has 16 freestanding contemporary lodges, 2 communal spaces, and plenty of outdoor space to enjoy with your pooch. Go to lodgesonvashon.com for more information, because sometimes your dog needs a vacation too.
There's a reason they invented the internet. It's called 1150kknw.com.
And now, back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
What a wonderful feeling to feel that way. Tell me, where have you been all my life? Oh, hot ziggity dog, ziggity boom, what you do to me?
Welcome back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. I'm thrilled to welcome back Dr. Temple Grandin. She was with us a little over a year ago for her first interview, and she is with us today to talk to us a little bit about the difference between pigs and dogs. I thought she'd be a good person to ask. Temple Grandin, welcome back to The Dog Show.
It's great to be back.
Thank you. So I've been seeing a lot of videos online about, you know, piglets, very, very young piglets. And, you know, the point is sort of showing how cute they are, and they're sort of running around and playing and all that kind of stuff. And it seems like there is a growing popularity where people are thinking that it's a good idea to have a pig as a pet, sort of like we have a dog as a pet. And I know that there are some complications to this and some things to consider and understand about pigs and how pigs are not dogs and ways that they are different.
Well, I think the first thing people have to look at is how big they get. A regular farm pig, I mean, it can, you sell them, you know, 500, 600 pounds, gets really big, 800 pounds. Mm-hmm. You know, and even if you get the miniature or the potbelly pig, you know, when they grow up, they weigh an average around 130 to 150 pounds.
That's big.
It gets to be a big animal. Mm-hmm. And another problem is they get destructive. Pigs root. Their whole, they just love to chew things up and root. And, you know, if you're thinking about this, I think you need to go to an animal shelter and see what a mature potbelly pig looks like. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the shelters have difficulty placing them, because even the potbelly pig gets bigger than some people think it's going to get.
Yeah. I think it's misleading to say if it's a miniature pig, it means it's not going to be 500 to 800 pounds. It's going to be maybe 150 pounds, which is still big.
That's still big. That's right. And yeah. That's bigger than most dogs are.
Yeah, for sure. So I was curious to know, in addition to the size, which seems to be one of the biggest concerns, and also their rooting behavior, which can be very destructive. I was curious to know from you, what are pigs like socially? What is their social structure?
Well, a mother pig will take really good care of her piglets. She'll grunt to her piglets to come up. The animal gets aware of something that's kind of novel. They'll bark. I can remember when I was working with pigs all the time, I'd be in the pig barn, and the small airport next to our pig barn, and a plane would fly over, and the whole barn would get silent for just a second while they oriented, and then they just start woofing and barking.
Hmm.
And then squealing. They're really upset when they're squealing.
Hmm. Was it scary?
They go, oh, that's a plane, and they start wolfing and barking. They do that every time a plane went over.
Uh-huh.
And they couldn't see it.
Yeah.
It was just hearing it.
So so what is the sort of domestication process? Like, domestic pigs came from wild...
They came from wild pigs originally, actually, in this U.S. right now, there's a lot of problems with feral pigs, and domestic pigs actually can interbreed with the wild pigs. And a lot of the behavior is the same. And if you want to have a pig as a pet, I'd recommend you're going to have to be putting a lot of time into it. And for most people, I think a dog might make a better pet.
Yeah. What does a pig need to be sort of fulfilled, to have their needs met?
They need a lot of things to root.
Uh-huh.
And some research that I did, I gave pigs a choice of objects that they could chew up and root. So they had a choice of a piece of hard chain, a piece of rubber hose, or a cloth strip. And they preferred the soft things that they could chew up and destroy. And I discuss that in detail in my book, Animals Make Us Human.
Mm-hmm.
But pigs spend a great deal of their life rooting in the ground. That's what they do in nature. To understand an animal's behavior, you need to start looking at what was that animal like out in nature. And pigs spend a lot of time rooting up the ground, and that can get a bit destructive in your house.
Yeah, for sure. Do they live in families, sort of, like dogs?
Yes. Well, yes, they do. Yeah, they don't live in huge herds, you know, like the wildebeest or the bison. They definitely are a social animal. And in Animals Make Us Human, one of the things I discuss are the emotional systems that mm-hmm. both people and animals have.
Mm-hmm.
And these were outlined by Jack Panskep, a neuroscientist, and he outlined these a good number of years ago. And you have fear, that's what happens when you get scared. You have rage, that enables either you or an animal to fight a predator off. Then you've got separation distress. You leave your dog home alone and he's chewed up the house. That's separation distress, or panic, and that's a separate emotional system from fear. And then you have seeking. Some animals have a big urge to explore. Other animals don't. Like one Labrador Retriever, all he wants to do is chase the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And another heavy-set Labrador Retriever is very content to be a service dog and to sit next to somebody's desk or next to somebody's wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both Labrador. One is a high seeker. The other one is a low seeker. And then, of course, you've got sex. You've got mother-young nurturing. And you've got play. And you need to look at each one of these traits sort of like a volume slot on the music mixing board.
Mm-hmm.
You can be high fear, low fear. High seek or low seek, you know, really playful or not so playful. They are continuous traits, and you can genetically select for them.
Mm. So different individual pigs, for example, would have a different level of, for example, that seeking, the need
to seek?
Would.
Yes, okay. There are different levels of it. And people have bred that in dogs. If you're going to go duck hunting, you want the dog that wants to go mm-hmm. out and get the ducks. Retrieve the ducks. If you want a good service dog, you want a dog's not interested in chasing things
right.
or going after the ball. You want them to just be quiet and happy to lay at somebody's desk all day.
Yeah.
And they're both Labrador Retriever. And I've seen that trait ever since I was a child. There were two black labs that lived in our neighborhood. And Hunter could care less about chasing the ball. And Tucky, this young female lab, really skinny and lanky, all she wanted to do all day was chase the ball. And she'd keep coming up to us, drop the ball in front of us, asking us to throw it over and over and over again. It just didn't stop.
Yeah.
And Hunter could have cared less about the ball.
Yeah. When you take a dog, for example, who has a high need for seeking, who's really interested in doing that, wants to be doing it all the time and is, you know, kind of looking for that. And I see this a lot, you know, working with dog training and behavior here in Seattle. And if you take a dog who has that high need for seeking and you don't give them an outlet for it, it seems like it causes them a lot of stress and unhappiness.
It does cause them a lot of stress. And the same thing with separation distress. Some dogs handle home alone better than others.
Mm-hmm.
The dog is a high seeker and needs to have you take it out and throw the tennis ball a whole bunch of times for it, get it out and really exercise it. And the low seeker is much more content to lay around. And that's also true for the separation anxiety. Some animals handle being home alone better than other animals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to work on teaching puppies when they're young to tolerate some time away from the owner and not be throwing a fit. But there's still big genetic differences in seeking behavior.
Yeah. Do you think
and in separation distress behavior?
Yeah. Do you think that there are some dogs who just are not equipped to spend a lot of time alone, no matter how much you try to work with them as puppies?
Yes, yes. I think there's some dogs where you need to needs to go to a doggy daycare center, or it needs to be left to the neighbor who will be with it. So there are some dogs who just don't handle being home alone well at all, and they're just very needy and very social. I want to tell you about some interesting research that I read about recently about the difference between dogs and wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And when we domesticated the dog, we bred this hyper-social, emotional animal, be very social.
Yeah.
And this is work that was done over in Europe. It's not my research, but really interesting research. And if you take a wolf, one that has been raised in captivity, so he's relatively tame.
Right.
And you have him watch another wolf opening up a puzzle box. The other wolf will watch and figure out how to get the box open. But the domestic dog's so busy asking us for help that lots of times it doesn't figure out how to open the box.
Mm.
So what this brings up is the wolf is more cognitive or thinking, and the domestic dog is sort of more social, emotional. You see, a brain can be more cognitive or a brain can be more social, emotional. And one of the papers is called Wolves Don't Do the Dance. And the other paper is, that wolves are better at, observing their conspecifics. That simply means its mates. It's, other wolves.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fancy word for, its mates.
Mm-hmm.
This is relatively recent research. Even though, wolves and dogs interbreed, they got all the same genetics, but there is this definite personality differences between the two species.
Yeah. So, since we were talking about pigs earlier, do pigs fall more under cognitive or social?
That's hard to say. Nobody's really studied this.
Mm.
That's been studied in domestic dogs compared to wolves. But I don't think anybody's actually studied that in pigs. But there's probably going to be differences in the rooting behavior because seeking is under, genetic influence. But I think the biggest problem you've got with pigs is their size. And another problem is, in order to keep them getting too fat, you've got to cut their food back. And that can make them grumpy.
Yeah.
And I've heard some disasters on the airlines with service pigs going to the bathroom in the forward galley and other sorts of things like that. And one of the airlines is not happy about that.
Oh, I'm sure not. I can't imagine what that smells like.
Well, that's right. I'm really glad I wasn't on that flight.
So one of the things that I've heard for years is sort of in advocates for better treatment in pigs in the meat industry and things like that. Pigs are as smart as dogs, or pigs are smarter than dogs. I hear that all the time.
Well, they definitely are smart. And why are dogs so easy to train? We've bred the dog so it wants to please us.
Mm-hmm.
It wants to do stuff. We've bred dogs that way. And pigs are easy to train, but you're probably going to need to use food motivation, clicker training. You can also train your cat to do all kinds of tricks with clicker training. Catherine Pryor's got some wonderful materials on that. She's got a relatively new book out where they got rid of all the behavior jargon. And she's got an old video called Clicker Magic that just shows amazing training a cat to kind of do a dog agility course, all with clicker training. It's food motivated.
Mm-hmm. So when I talked with you the first time, which was a year ago, March, and we were getting ready for the Seattle Kennel Club dog show that was coming up, and there was a story of a woman who was competing in an obedience skit with her pet pig.
How did he do?
She did pretty well, but you were right. You said, I bet that training is going to be much more food-based than would need to be with a dog. And as I was watching her running her pig, whose name is Amy, through these sort of tricks, there was a lot of luring that was happening.
Well, yeah, and dogs will do it just to get praise and stroking. Okay, while we're talking about stroking, don't pat your animals. Stroke them.
Mm.
You want to stroke them, make it feel like the mother's tongue licking them.
Mm.
Sometimes patting is interpreted as hitting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't want to stroke them. That's what you want to do.
Yeah. Well,
that's why dogs are so easy to train.
Yeah. So dogs are more motivated by, and I think we're generalizing, so certainly some dogs more than others.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Some dogs are more social than others. And the dogs that are closer to the wild type don't seem to be quite so affectionate. They're more cognitive. A brain can be more thinking, or a brain can be made more social-emotional. We've bred dogs to be really social-emotional to make them easy to train.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was that the one of the effects of the domestication of dogs has had them sort of remain socially immature for their whole life relative to wolves?
Well, basically, yes. That's called neoteny, or keeping the juvenile traits. And in both Animals in Translation and my other book, Animals Make Us Human, I discuss this.
Mm-hmm.
But another big thing I'm concerned about is where dogs are going genetically. I am hearing too many stories about a 3-year-old yellow lab got epilepsy, can no longer use it for a guide dog. 6-year-old yellow lab has got freezing kind of seizures. Bulldogs that can barely breathe.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up a picture online. It's called Bulldog's Dilemma. It's a 1938 picture from the New York Times of a bulldog. And you've got an animal. It's got some snout. It's got legs. It's a functional dog. And then you look at what some of these bulldogs are today, difficulty walking, difficulty breathing, can't have the babies naturally. You know, just over the years, they kept selecting more and more and more for the, stocky and, short nose and different kinds of traits until you got getting some animals that are really having a serious problem.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think these animals, why is their health being so disregarded by people who are supposedly the enthusiasts of the breed?
I think the problem is it's what I call bad becoming normal. It happens slowly. You see, and the breed standard is a verbal standard. If the picture from the New York Times in 1938 had been used as the breed standard, this would have been less likely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just have a verbal breed standard, the dogs slowly change. And then over the years, people don't realize it. I've seen problems with that with lameness in dairy cattle.
Mm.
When I first started out, and that was a long time ago, maybe 5% of dairy cows were lame, and you've got some dairies where 25% of the cows are lame. And this happens slowly, and people don't really see it. Now, I first started to notice some of these genetic differences in some pigs, at the commercial pigs, when they went to the slaughter plant being very, very hyper. Because I was seeing pigs from many, many different producers. But a breeder that's just breeding one particular kind of pig doesn't see how his pigs behave compared to other people's pigs. I call this, bad becoming normal. And back in the 80s, when the lean line pigs first started, we have a lot of problems with a hyperstartle response. Now, nobody deliberately breeds for that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't see other pigs, I would go into the packing plant and rattle the gates, and there'd be certain genetic lines of pigs where they just start screeching and jumping all around. Go to the next pen, I'd rattle the gate and wouldn't even get up. These were genetic differences in startle.
Mm-hmm.
And I had somebody say to me, well, you're not a geneticist. How would you know? I said, I got one qualification you don't have. I'm seeing more pigs from more different places than you've ever seen.
Yeah.
See, a lot of breeders are just looking at their own animals. And I find when I go to a high school or I go to college and they have bulldogs for a mascot, I love to look at the old pictures from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bulldog is a whole lot less extreme.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe we need to get that Bulldog's Dilemma from 1938 and everyone who breeds bulldogs needs to see that picture.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's an interesting point to see how that it's...
And this doesn't mean that people are bad. These things happen and don't realize.
Yeah.
Like you have younger people now coming in maybe breeding bulldogs. There was a bulldog puppy in my apartment complex a few years ago, and we threw the ball for it, and it would get tired. And the young student that had the dog just says, oh, well, that's the way the breed is. Well, this is what how it was when I was a child.
Yeah.
See, this is one advantage that's been around for a long time. This is what I call bad becoming normal.
Yeah.
And it's happened with many different things. You over-select for any single trait, you're going to get in trouble. And, of course, you want to have guide dogs and you want to have service dogs that are really calm. You over-select for that calm trait. I think that might be behind some of this epilepsy, because you might want to read about the Belyeff experiments. I've talked about that in Animals Make Us Translation. Belyeff was a Russian scientist, and he bred foxes to be gentle.
Right.
They were raising foxes for fur, and they wanted a gentle fox that wouldn't rip your hand off. So all he did was select the foxes that wouldn't bite your hand off. And after about 20 generations, they got this stocky, black and white, border collie fox dog.
Yeah.
That was much more like a domestic dog. But then they kept over-selecting for the trait, and they got epilepsy.
Mm. Was that called flight distance? The trait?
Flight distance, but also, you know, if you put your hand in the cage, did it bite it or did it lick it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then basically they wanted to breed a fox you could handle and touch so that a fox wouldn't bite your hand off. And so they select for the tamer fox. They changed its coloration. They changed its physical shape from skinny and lanky to more heavy set. And then they overdid it, and they got neurological problems.
Mm.
And you over-select for any appearance or behavior trait, you're going to wreck your animal. Mm-hmm. And what happens is people do this slowly, and they don't realize it. I mean, I want to make it very clear that, you know, you've got, you know, good people breeding animals, and they don't even realize this is happening. And anybody who's out there who's a real serious animal breeder might want to get my textbook, Genetics and the Behavior of Domestic Animals. It is kind of pricey because it is a textbook.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got scientists from all around the world, and I've got chapters in there on the students of Belly F on dogs. I've got chapters on chickens, chapters on pigs. And, there are big genetic differences in how animals behave.
Well, and I know with some breeds, it's to the point now where just the population for some of the genetic diversity is so limited that it's hard to even bring in diversity anymore.
Oh, they're going to have to open up some of these stud books.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going to have to. Because some of these problems, it's just not acceptable. I'm just hearing about more and more kind of weird epilepsy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say 3 or 4 year old dogs getting epilepsy. That's bad. That's not normal.
Do you think that I know like golden retrievers, for example, that the rate of cancer is so high.
They've been bad for years because when I was a child, we had a golden, he died at 5 from cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely terrible. There's genetic aspects of that, and they've been bad for years. But just in the last few years, I'm hearing more and more stuff about the epilepsy. I talked to a lady who was blind who had retired 2 guide dogs because they got epilepsy at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
That's terrible.
It's...
Yeah, you want to have a really calm guide dog that isn't going to spook, but you breed it over-select for that calmness trait, then you start to get abnormalities.
It's interesting how certain traits are connected.
They're connected, and I don't really know why.
Yeah.
But you see, Belly F found the same thing. He bred the fox that would be gentle, and they kept doing it and doing it and doing it until they got really serious problems. You know, now you just do it in moderation, it's fine.
Right.
But you see, the problem is these problems creep up on you slowly, so people don't realize it. You know, you don't realize how many problems today's bulldogs got until you go back and you look at those pictures. You know, if your school or your college had the bulldog as a mascot, I strongly recommend you go look at the pictures from the 60s, the 50s, the 40s. You're going to see a very, very different animal. And I've done that every time I go to a school that's got a bulldog as a mascot, I've done that.
Yeah. So I've heard a lot of people, my clients who have me come out because they're having some sort of challenge with their dog. And a lot of times they say, I don't remember our family dogs when I was a kid, you know, in the 70s, for example, I don't remember ever having to kind of think about any of these kinds of things that our dogs never did that. And I feel like, well, one, you were probably a child, so you didn't, you know, look at the dog in the same way. But I think that there's some validity to that. How do you think dogs in general?
I think a lot of the behavior problems are caused by lack of socialization. When I was a child, and this would have been 50s, now I'm telling you how old I am, all the dogs ran loose in the neighborhood. They were mostly Goldens and Labs, and then some crossbreds. And we didn't have all these behavior problems. Puppies chewed things, and that was about it. But dogs were getting socialized to toddlers. You can get a very dangerous situation if you don't socialize puppies to toddlers. They've got to learn that toddlers are people, too. Mm-hmm. And these dogs were all socialized. And we had some rules when we were a kid. Don't pet strange dogs you don't know. Don't bother them when they're eating. And when the dog bit somebody, the parents would go, "What did you do to it?"
Right.
The first thing that they would ask. You see, today, with all the leash laws, like here in Fort Collins where I live, you have to have your dog on a leash. And so to get it properly socialized, you're going to have to take it out to the dog park. I mean, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And then you have a dog that's reared by itself, and then it fights other dogs because it hasn't learned how to socialize. That's actually creating some of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
For example, our Golden that ran loose, there was another Golden that lived next door, and he was dominant over Andy. And Andy would go over to Lightning's house, roll over to submit the Lightning, and then they'd go play.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy would go over to Lightning's house. Okay, Lightning was dominant, but then they played.
Yeah.
And there was nothing to make our dog go to Lightning's house.
Right.
I used to see him do that all the time. And some of the worst fights you have is animals reared alone. I've seen it in dogs. I've seen it in horses. I've seen it in cattle.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to learn that give and take of social behavior, both as puppies and as, when they're adolescents. Really important thing.
It seems like another aspect of that too is that those dogs had a lot more freedom and so had a lot more stimulation, not just interaction and
That's
socialization,
right.
But for example, we were talking about the whole seeking thing. They had a lot of opportunity to explore.
Oh, they did lots and lots of exploration.
Yeah.
I mean, I see dogs out for walks and they've got these big long 25-foot tape measure leashes.
Mm-hmm.
The dog's out sniffing the grass and stuff like that, or somebody's just breeding the dog and it sniffs the tree and they just jerk it away and they won't let it check its P-mail. And,
right.
They're leading kind of a boring life. Another thing I want to talk about in behavior problems, when we're trying to solve a behavior problem, people tend to overgeneralize.
Yeah.
And they expect you to answer it. They'll say, "My dog is crazy." I go, "Okay, what did it do?"
Yeah.
So I'm a visualizer. I think in pictures, so I'm thinking, is it some cute little dog that's jumping on somebody all happy or something big and nasty, biting somebody? What do you mean it's crazy? You've got to give me a whole lot more information.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the big problems when you're trying to troubleshoot any behavior problem.
Yeah.
You got to know exactly what the dog did, first of all.
Yeah, and also understand that dog as an individual.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely right. But I find the same problem with horse behavior problems, too.
Yeah.
The same problem with overgeneralizing.
So there's... we talked about this last time too, about how we both share this experience where people will ask a question and then it's like, "Well, I really would need to meet your dog in order to answer the question and get some more information about that." And that you can't generalize and that every dog is a unique individual.
Well, they are. That's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just, sort of how people overgeneralize to such a degree, like saying a dog is crazy.
Right.
That doesn't give you any information as to whether it's like an aggression problem or maybe
right.
it just likes to jump on people.
Right, yeah. right. What does that look like? So back to the pigs. So we started out talking about this sort of growing popularity of this idea that pigs would make a great pet. And I wanted to ask you about these part because they're so piglets are cute. I mean,
well, piglets are really cute.
But these videos that they're showing where they are so, so cute is that they're so small. And one of the things that I heard someone who sort of is in the pig community is that they are being separated. One of the problems is that they're also being separated way too young from their mothers to be that small. And, that when you get a piglet who's that small, they're way too young to be away from their mom.
Well, yeah, and the other thing is, even in commercial pigs, they'll wean them at 4 weeks, but then they go into a pen with a social group of other pigs. They're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems you have when you keep animals alone, you bring another animal and it's fighting.
Yeah.
Because they haven't learned social interaction.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing people have got to understand is how big they get.
Yeah.
And in some cases, destructive they can get.
Well, those are the two big things that I knew that the size was a problem, but didn't appreciate, and as you said, they really need to root around and that they really like to not only root around, but to sort of destroy what they find as well and eat it.
Well, they like to chew up soft things, because when I did my research, I hung a rubber hose over their pen, a cloth strip, and a metal chain. And each one of these objects was attached to a little switch that was hooked up to a counter, so I could actually get the pig's votes on which thing they liked to chew up the best.
Yeah.
And the chain was the least preferred. They liked the things that they could actually chew up and wreck and destroy, things
yeah.
they could destruct. They want soft things to chew up. The hard chain did not give them the chewing satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
An ideal material is something like straw, which they can then chew up.
Right.
But pigs need stuff to root and chew on.
Yeah. Well, I very much appreciate your time with us and sharing your insight, not only on what it would be like to live with a pig and the challenges, and sort of with the point of discouraging people ultimately, that just because you saw a video of an adorable piglet doesn't mean that, and just because they say pigs are as smart as dogs doesn't mean that it's kind of like having a dog, but it's a pig. It's
well,
a very different animal.
Just the pure size. They can be housebroken, but there's the pure size of them. I've seen pictures of full-sized domestic pig about collapsing a couch.
Yeah.
And that's how heavy they're going to get. And I have a chapter on pigs in my book, Animals Make Us Human, you might want to read. Also, the book describes all the emotional systems. And there's still some scientists out there that want to deny animals' emotions. But the research is very clear. They have the same neurotransmitters that we have, the same emotional brain systems. And also, pharmaceuticals, such as Prozac, do work on dogs. That's another indicator that there are similarities.
Mm-hmm. So it's a surprising that that would still be an idea that's resisted.
I think their emotions, for example, you neuter a dog. I don't think the dog's going, oh, I just lost my manhood.
Right.
Okay. That's something only a person can understand.
Right. Their experience, it seems like, is they have not like people, but that they have a very sort of rich, complex emotional world. It's just different.
They definitely do.
Yeah.
But the other thing, before we go, mm-hmm. I want to talk about is an animal lives in a sensory-based world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the dog's social life is a world of thousands and thousands of smells. Like, he checks out the local tree, knows who's been there, when they were there. Animals such as cattle, for example, notice little visual changes. It's sensory-based, not word-based.
Mm-hmm.
And animals can get fear memories. If you have an animal that's been abused, he might be afraid of people wearing baseball hats. Or maybe somebody raises any stick-like object scares it.
Mm-hmm.
They can get a fear memory that's associated with something they were seeing or hearing right the moment that the bad experience happened.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get a rescue animal, it seems really scared, and you can figure out what it's afraid of and maybe get rid of the baseball hats, then it may be a whole lot calmer.
Mm-hmm.
And it can sometimes really take some detective work to figure out what stimuli is setting it off.
Does it have to be something like abuse to trigger that? Or could it be that an individual experienced had a sort of fearful experience and then associate something with it? Like, to what degree of the fear does it need to be in order for that to...
I had some really bad experience. A lot of dogs get afraid of the vet.
Mm-hmm.
And let's make puppy's first experience, the vet, a good experience.
Yeah.
Let's start with giving it a non-slip floor to stand on. So maybe take a bath mat in with a rubber mat. Because, getting on the slippery table, the first visit should just be lots of treats. Because if the first visit to the vet is a really bad experience, the dog's going to be afraid every time it goes to the vet.
Right.
It's really important that an animal's first experience with a new person, a new place, or a new anything is a good first experience. Okay, you're going to train the dog to go in the crate. Let's make the crate a good place.
Mm-hmm.
If its first experience is just being jammed in it...
And left alone.
That's not good.
Yeah. Jammed in it and left alone for hours.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's totally terrible.
Yeah.
It's a sensory-based world. I want you to get away from language when you think about animal behavior. And in my first book, Animals in Translation, I talk a lot about the importance of getting away from verbal language. I mean, think about tone. lot of the animal behavior research shows how animals communicate with tone of voice.
Yeah.
You know, like the grunt in the mother sow, that's a positive thing. A high-pitched squeal is definitely a negative, scary or painful thing. Mm-hmm. And the bark is sort of a vigilance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly something that I think humans tend to be challenged with, is we are a little hyperverbal. And have
a lot of people that are good with animals. Just, I've seen a lot of dyslexic horse trainers that are really super good with animals.
Interesting.
They just get it. But I want you to close your eyes and think about, what is your dog smelling? What is he seeing? What's he orienting towards? Try to get away from words.
Yeah.
And I think the closest that humans have gotten to smelling like a dog is some wine stewards that I've read about.
Mm.
They can identify a thousand wines by smell.
Mm.
That's certainly not me. That is a world of smell detail that we can just only imagine.
Yeah. So do you think that that's something that that individual was sort of born with and then has refined with practice? Like, is a combination of the two?
I think it's a combination of the two.
Yeah.
Because I'm an extreme visual thinker and always have been. You know, on work I've done with equipment design, I can test run it in my mind. And then when I talk to people about behavior problems and they start to describe what their dog is doing, I can actually build up videos in my head of the dog, you know, using pictures that I've already got in memory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a cute little white fluffy thing. Yep, I've got pictures of that in my mind, and I've got pictures of a snarly, nasty dog I saw at a hotel one time.
Yeah.
And I can start, you know, I get very specific images.
So say you're trying to understand an individual dog and somebody's sort of telling you, or you're seeing what the dog is doing, are you able to connect the visual with emotion?
Yes, yeah. And then I'm thinking about Jack Panskep's emotional systems.
Yep.
I think if you read about that, it's really going to help you. Both of my books discuss it. It's discussed more intently in Animals Make Us Human.
Yeah.
And this is based in neuroscience. See, another problem we've gotten in science is that all the stuff on animal emotion has been all kind of hidden over in the neuroscience literature.
Yeah.
Because there's a number of people that sort of want to deny animals' emotions. Now there's still a lot of discussion going on about that. And I got to thinking, what really does separate us from the animals? It's not tool making. It's not culture. It's libraries. Because Franz de Waal has a new book on animal intelligence. And Jane Goodall found out that, you know, the apes make tools.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one thing that none of the animals can do, build up a library.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, you made this kind of tool, and then you write about it, others can write about it, and then make something better. Animals don't have libraries of knowledge. That's one of the things that language has done for us. It's writing. It's being able to record your experiences for others to read. That's the thing I think is the most unique. Because there's a lot of very rich emotional communication and communication in animals that's tone of voice.
Mm-hmm.
They convey all kinds of social information.
But they're not writing books about it.
They don't write books about it. And they're not going to go to the moon.
Right.
And they're not going to build radio stations.
Right.
Those are things they're not going to do.
Yeah,
I got to thinking about, and I read a review on Franz de Waal's new book. And the last sentence of the review, and I don't remember who wrote it, said, one of the differences between us and the animals is you're reading this review. They did not write it.
Right. Right.
I think I really got to thinking about that. It's being able to build vast libraries of knowledge
mm-hmm.
that they can pass on generation after generation after generation.
So animals are able to pass on in some
ways.
They
can pass on, okay, how to make this particular tool.
Mm.
But they can't write down the directions on exactly how to make it.
Right.
And their children can read those directions.
Right.
And then they can make something better and build on that knowledge the same way.
Well, and animals learn through experience.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can't.
And people do too.
Right.
But yeah. I can look up, I can go online and look up something on how to make a stone spear.
Mm-hmm.
I was just talking to somebody the other day that teaches kids how to make a caveman tools.
Uh-huh.
It's a really fun thing for kids to do. And there'll be a video that'll show you exactly how to do it.
Right. That's interesting.
You know, it's the ability to amass vast amounts of knowledge. I'm going to call it libraries. The ability to put information into tremendous libraries. Mm-hmm. That's something that I think that's something we can really still do. And they're not going to build things like radio stations.
Right.
But they do build some really intricate stuff. I was down in the outback in Australia looking at the termites nests. Hmm. That was really interesting.
Yeah. I think the mistake that we make is that we think, well, you know, animals, they can't build libraries, for example. But that doesn't mean that they're not having a rich emotional experience.
They have an emotional experience.
Sure.
I mean, to deny them emotions, I just think is absolutely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at the brain structures, and Jack Penskep's got a lot of scientific papers, and you might want to look them up on Google Scholar. That's spelled Panksep, P as in Paul, A, N as in Never, K as in Kitchen, S as in Sally, E, P as in Paul, Jack. And Jack is, it's not the U.S. spelling. It's got two A's in it.
Mm.
And he's got a lot of papers, and it's very clear. And the other thing that some of the people that deny animals' emotions leave out is all of the practical experience and research that shows that psychiatric drugs work on animals.
Yeah.
That tells you that the emotional systems have got to be pretty similar.
Right. Well, it's convenient, I think, to say that they don't. So then
I think it's ridiculous to say they don't, because the brain structures are the same.
Yeah.
But when you look at the brain, the big difference between us and the animals is the size of the cortex.
Mm-hmm.
We have processor power upstairs, just raw processor power,
mm-hmm.
that they don't have. But the emotional circuits down the base of the brain, that stuff's pretty much the same.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. You go into a lot of depth. I know I learned a lot, and it was sort of my introduction to this was when I read your book, Animals Make Us Human, which was the topic of our conversation a little over a year ago in our first interview here. And then you have another book, Animals in Translation.
Yes.
And as well as some other publications. They're excellent, excellent books. There's also what I thought was a wonderful, I don't know if you what you think of it, but about the movie that was made about you called Temple Grandin.
I thought they did a great job with the movie. They showed how my visual thinking works.
Yeah.
Oh, Mick Jackson, the director, he just absolutely got it.
Mm.
But if you watch that movie, you know, I'm thinking in pictures, not in words.
Yeah.
And in Animals in Translation, I talk about how autism helped me with animal behavior because I'm an extreme visual thinker.
Yeah.
You know, and as we're talking about these things now, I'm getting pictures.
Yeah.
We talked about different kinds of dogs. I get pictures of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting, and it's wonderful that you're able to communicate your experience to help us understand not only animals but also people with autism.
Well, you've got to get away from verbal language is one of the things you've got to do if you want to understand animals.
Yeah.
You know, you wonder why we have music. Well, maybe that's something to do with the animal mind, because animals communicate with tone of voice, and music's on a different set of circuits.
Have you had any experience with animals enjoying or not enjoying music?
Oh, I've heard dogs howl in the time of music.
Now, does that mean that they like it or that they don't like it?
I'm not sure, but there's videos online, and I've looked them up, cockatoos and other birds dancing in time to music.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got to be enjoying that.
Yeah. I saw some, there's some videos of like the poodles, it seems like poodle-type dogs standing on a piano bench, hitting a piano key, and then howling and then hitting another one and howling, and it's like, oh
well,
my gosh.
They must be liking that because they're going up and hitting it.
I know, right?
Nobody's making them do it.
Yeah. You know, it's like, my gosh, this animal seems like it's really moved by the music it's making. It's kind of funny.
Well, if it keeps doing it, it's got to have, you know, some reason for liking it.
Right, right. Yeah, you
wouldn't. The emotional centers in the brain are pretty much the same in all mammals.
Mm. Well, it's a big thing to contemplate as we appreciate welfare issues of other animals and what we sort of put them through for our own gain.
Well, people get concerned about, you know, animal welfare of farm animals. I get really concerned about the welfare of some of these dogs that are just home alone all day, because I've, middle of the afternoon walk through the neighborhood and I hear all the dogs howling behind the doors in the different houses.
Yeah.
They're not having a good time at all.
Yeah. Seems like they're lonely.
Yeah, we've bred this animal to be socially needy, and so that makes them easy to train. That's why they're our best friend.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time. I could talk with you forever, but we have to wrap things up. So I want to make sure people know the titles of your books. Highly, highly recommend them. Animals Make Us Human and Animals in Translation.
Yes.
And then you mentioned that you have a textbook as well that could be helpful.
My textbook is Genetics and the Behavior of Domestic Animals. It would be Temple Grandin and Mark Diesing. And that is a more expensive book, but someone was really seriously interested in looking at some of the scientific research on behavior genetics of domestic animals.
Yeah.
And it's got chapters on pigs, on horses, on just in general, dogs, chickens. And there's a lot that's been, you know, a lot of different behavior traits have a strong genetic basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's wonderful what you've contributed to our understanding of animals. Thank you so much for your time today on The Dog Show. It was a pleasure to have you back, and I look forward to talking with you again in the future.
Okay, great to talk to you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye.
All right, we'll be back in just a few minutes. You're listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
The bluest skies you've ever seen are in Seattle, and the hills the greenest green in Seattle. Like a beautiful child growing up free and wild,
full of hopes and full of fears, full of laughter, full of tears, full of dreams to last the years in Seattle.
This is Julie Forbes. I'm excited to tell you about Farm Dog Naturals, a company that handcrafts herbal remedies for the all-natural dog. Quality and integrity are must-haves for anything that I recommend. Certified eco-friendly and cruelty-free, their products address issues like stress and anxiety, itching, hot spots, crusty noses, as well as pet urine, stains, and odor. Farm Dog Naturals is guaranteed, and I'm so happy with the results I'm seeing. Shipping is available worldwide from their website, farmdognaturals.com, or you can ask for them at a retailer near you. Again, that's farmdognaturals.com.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Anti-Icky Poo, the product that gets the stink out, we cover the world of animals. This week, June 19th, it's Harmonic and Energy Shifting Sunday with Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon Center in Seattle. They'll be in the studio with their acutonic forks, Tibetan bowls and bells, poo-a-didge and rattles, ready to do remote sessions for you, your animal friends, your home or business. Open phone lines throughout the show, so call in early. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Eric, people ask me to help them with all sorts of doggy challenges.
I can only imagine.
Oh yeah, dogs jumping on guests, new puppy questions, behavioral challenges like fear and aggression, even dog food sensitivities. You name it, and I've probably worked with it.
But can you help people even if they don't live in Seattle?
Absolutely. I've had great success with phone consultations and have even Skyped with people and their dogs from all over the country. Every dog should be approached as a unique individual. I've talked about this over and over again on the show. That's one of the parts of working with dog training and behavior that I love the most. Every client is different. If you're listening and you need help with your dog, just get in touch. I'd love to get you pointed in the right direction and answer all of your questions. Email me, host@dogradioshow.com. That's me, Julie Forbes. host@dogradioshow.com. I look forward to connecting.
Wait, dogs can use Skype? We're really living in the future.
The Natural Pet Pantry is Seattle's original source for wholesome dog and cat meals, offering 8 different protein options to accommodate your pet's dietary needs. Made locally using all U.S.-sourced ingredients, their freshly ground stews, raw or cooked, can be purchased from their 2 stores in Burien and Kirkland, most independent pet supply stores, or delivered right to your door. Go to naturalpetpantry.com for more information. I'm Julie Forbes, and my first choice for my pet's food is the Natural Pet Pantry. It's the educated choice.
Self-help, healing, spirituality, and more on Alternative Talk, 1150.
And now, back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
In Seattle, like a beautiful child growing up free and wild, full of hopes and full of
welcome back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. Eric, thanks so much for the Perry Como this episode. I was telling Eric how I had been playing a lot of Perry Como for Nana as we were sitting with her in her last days, because that was her favorite. She loved Perry Como. Never missed his Christmas special, I guess, that he used to do. So
both the songs we played, yeah. Hot Diggity Dog and, of course, Seattle, Go Out to Nana.
Thank you. I would never listen to Perry Como except that I knew that it was Nana's favorite, and so we wanted her to hear some of her favorite music. And she wasn't able to communicate and sort of looked like she was sleeping, but we were told that she could still hear. And if you can still hear us now, Nana, love you very much, and I hope that you're in a better place. But Perry Como has a nice voice, and he sings a lot of popular songs, Unchained Melody, Yesterday. I can't think of the other ones that I had heard sung by other artists. So it was not a bad singer to listen to.
Anybody that does an anthem for our city, we got to doff our caps.
That's right. If you would like to receive a Dog Show car sticker, you can email me. I'm sending a couple more out to New York. I just got an email this week. We've sent them all over the world now, and I'm happy to get some out to you. You just let me know how many you want, and they are oval, and they look like the logo on our website, which is dogradioshow.com. You can email me, host@dogradioshow.com, and just request however many stickers you want. Send me your address, your mailing address, and I'll get them out to you. You can find all of our episodes archived on our website, on iTunes as a free podcast, and also posted from our Facebook page through SoundCloud. Thanks so much for being with us again this week, and we'll be here next week. Thanks for listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
You've been listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, Wednesday afternoons at 2 on Alternative Talk 1150 AM. Never miss another episode. Listen to our podcast online at dogradioshow.com or download them for free on iTunes or SoundCloud.